It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Usually when we talk about farm to table talk, we're talking about farms and tables that are in the United States, but there's some interesting things happening all over the world, and there's people from the States that are getting around the world and looking at what is happening around the world. Our guest today is Ellen Farmer, and Ellen has a very unique perspective. She went to some place that some of us haven't been to yet, and that's to Cuba. And you wonder what you see when you go down to Cuba. You see all the pictures of people driving very old American cars because they haven't had trade. But what about the agriculture? Ellen, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you.
So why did you go to Cuba, and what took you out to look around and see what was going on with farming and agriculture in Cuba?
Well, I'm very interested in agriculture in the States, and I had talked to a lot of people who had been to a farm tour that happens every other year in Cuba, and it's the entire nation's cooperative farming group that puts this on. They invite people from all over Latin America and Europe and the United States, so it was about 200 people and about 20 buses, and they took us around two farms in areas of our interest, and they have a really wonderful cooperative system there with promoters, and they promote best practices in farming. So they call it agroecology, which I love because that's, you know, it's a growing term here, but there it's the norm. It's sort of like when we say organic, I think they're saying agroecology. And so their practices are without the use of pesticides, you know, taking care of the land, multi-species cover crops, silvopasture, animal welfare, all these practices are what they were showing us. And it's very inexpensive. And I hope to take a group in a couple of years when it happens again, because it's just eye-opening to see people working together like that.
Now, are they able to own the farms themselves in Cuba? Because they've got this vision of what the communist world used to be like. So do they have private ownership of farms?
What has happened is, in the last 5 to 10 years, the government realized that they couldn't just support everybody in government jobs anymore. So they've been inching towards entrepreneurial practices throughout the island, and there was a lot of government-owned land that they needed people to farm, just so that people in different parts of the country would have access to vegetables and local produce and animals, like, you know, pigs for pork and things like that. So they give them, I think they're like 99-year leases, something along those lines. And they, if they want to build a house there, they can get a loan, and the co-ops actually back them on the loan. So they may have a job in the city, but they're building their house in the country on this land that they've got a long-term lease for. And if they're successful and they keep going and they farm, they get lots of support from these co-ops.
Now, the co-ops, are they, what's their connection to the government in Cuba?
They're pretty well connected. It's like a big government agency, the Ministry of Agriculture. And the co-ops would be the sort of entrepreneurial worker family farm arm of that. Mm-hmm. They also still grow sugarcane and tobacco in Cuba, and those are sort of more major farms, more industrial type farming, I think government owned, but that's what they grow for export. But what these farms do is grow for their local communities, and they're developing farmers markets now, learning about CSAs. It's a new emerging entrepreneurial society there, which I'm really in support of.
Well, it strikes me, though, that they would have had farmers markets from the outset. It seems like when they were going through so many years that they weren't advancing to the same pace as we do in the United States. So they don't have these huge supermarkets.
Right.
And so I would suspect that they were buying and trading and bartering local foods for a long time.
Well, actually, most of their food was supplied by the government.
Really?
So the farmers, like, so let's say you had a hog farm. You would sell all the meat to the government, and then the government would distribute it to the people, like 25 years ago.
But that didn't work very well.
No. And it was all based on an economy from the Soviet Union buying their sugar for, you know, exorbitant prices, basically, and giving them oil so they could run their machinery and so forth. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, they went through something called the special period, which is when most people lost like 20 pounds. They barely had any calories to eat every day. And it was just a crisis. And so that's when they started planting anything they could grow in urban farms around Havana and the urban areas. And these best practices started to emerge. They started learning to be good farmers. I mean, in Cuba, actually, their cuisine, they don't even really like to eat vegetables very much, but they love meat, and they do import a lot of rice. So their main dish would be, like, say, arroz con pollo, which is, you know, chicken and rice and some beans on the side. And mostly they love meat. So the idea is, if you could have these family farms that have animals as well as fruit trees and other crops, they grow coffee there. You know, the diversity on the farm itself makes for a really good farm, sort of like the old style U.S. family farms.
So if these farms are being kind of recreated with this, the co-ops helping them get started, and they're able to get these 99-year leases and mm-hmm. so forth, so what might typical farms look like? Are they, you know, about 50 acres, 100 acres, or what? You get a sense for the size of these farms?
The ones we visited were pretty small. I would say 20 acres or less. And the ones that were very well cared for and new had animal pens, you know, with they would clean out the droppings or whatever you want to call it for to make that into fertilizer. The animals, there was a lot of animal welfare concern. And then because it's the tropics, they have all these fruit trees, so they can have shade grown coffee and other things. And then some of the farms had large raised beds, and they were starting to grow vegetables like beets and so forth, and carrots. And so they're developing all of those types of crops, vegetable crops, increasing those, and also learning to cook them and learning to make them part of their cuisine.
So most of the farms, though, would have these fruits or vegetables and have, what, hogs and chickens?
Yep.
A bit cattle, too?
Yep, very common, and dairy cows.
Oh, so that they're milking. So, again, fairly small scale.
Yeah.
And are they pretty self-supporting, just the family themselves? They don't really probably need many more people for a small farm to
See a lot of farm workers. It was the people who lived there, and their next door neighbor would also have a farm, so they were farming communities. And we also went to a goat farm and a honey bee farm, and they were actually inseminating the honeybee queens. So that was one of the big displays that we got to see, because on the island they have no
that could be a whole new podcast all by itself.
They have, what is it called when the colony collapse of the honeybees? They don't have that in Cuba. It's an island, and their honeybee population is incredibly healthy. So island honey is a big thing for them.
I mean, do they assume that had something to do with the fact that there weren't so many pesticides available to them in Cuba?
I assume that. I'm not sure what the reason is. I think people are studying it. But, yeah, for many, many years, they had pesticides when the Soviet Union was there, and then they didn't have them all during the 90s. And so they learned to farm organically.
Now, that's interesting. So they really didn't have much of a choice. It wasn't necessarily that they're saying, oh, let's take the high road. It's like they couldn't get the stuff.
Right.
And so they were forced to learn how to produce. Do they call it organic, or do they call it something else, or is it just the way things are done in Cuba?
Well, I don't think there's really a strong certification effort there. I think maybe some European Swiss certifiers may be there in some cases, but more they're just trying to make it affordable to farm. And when you have to buy, you know, fertilizers and pesticides, that's not affordable.
Right.
So they just learned from each other how to be successful keeping the pests away and the diseases away.
And so if you've got a small farm, say if I happen to be in Cuba and I have this small farm out in the edge of one of the bigger cities, and it's maybe 25, 30 acres, and I've got some pigs, I've got the fruits and vegetables. Where do they slaughter? How do they process the have abattoirs that they can take their hogs to be processed?
I think so. I don't think they have portable ones. I think they have to take them somewhere, or they may process them right on the farm.
Yeah,
it seemed to me like that would historically have been established when the government was in charge. And things like that in Cuba that are, you know, they build the building at some point, say in the 1980s, you know, they take care of those buildings. Those, mm-hmm. they really value that infrastructure, so.
Well, it's sort of a, well, it's not sort of, it is a tropical environment. And so, you know, they don't have to worry about frost at all. And they've got these products of their own, and there are more and more small farms that are taking place in there. And you say they talk about them as being agroecology, mm-hmm. which is something that's a term we use in the United States. It's confusing to many people. There's people still trying to figure out for sure what that means.
Right, right.
And they've kind of leapfrogged into that, something that just the way they've had to be doing things in Cuba.
Yeah, and some of their close friends in academia are the people who developed agroecology, like Miguel Altieri. And so he's been traveling there forever and has close ties.
He's with UC Berkeley.
Yeah. And so the close ties that he has with the people developing best practices there, they started using that terminology. But also all over Latin America with La Via Campesina is what I learned on my trip. They really promote agroecology. Mm-hmm. And agroecological farming, I think now there's a term called regenerative agriculture.
Yes.
That is very similar to what the agroecology people are talking about. What you're doing is taking care of your soil, valuing your soil, and feeding your soil rather than just giving fertilizer to a plant, you know, like a monocrop kind of thing. You're aware of the whole environment that your plants are in and how the trees may interact with the vegetable crops and the animals, and everything is more holistic.
Oh. Now, so you've got these farms coming up across Cuba. For the average consumer, mm-hmm. are they primarily interacting by either going directly to farms or going to the farmers markets, or are some of it going to grocery stores? Where do they purchase these products from the farmers?
I think produce markets are the main way in the cities, and they have to use diesel trucks to get the food into the cities. And then there are urban farms also, but the most people live in cities. So if they're going to get this, it has to be transported, which is one of the issues. And farmers markets and fair pricing and open markets, that's completely new for most of the people there who are over the age of 30. It's not what they're trained in. They're trained in, you know, sort of a communist system where the food is provided to you by the government. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge learning curve for them to figure out what's a fair price and how not to undercut each other and, you know, all of, and keeping the market, making a market. So what I'm hoping to do is have exchanges with farmers here who are learning these practices at training centers here, and then they can talk about what they're learning in terms of marketing, farmers markets, CSAs, that kind of thing. They can exchange that with the Cubans who can talk to us about co-ops and how do you solve problems in a cooperative environment? How do you support each other? How do you teach each other? That's what they're really good at.
Well, and the co-ops in the United States are not that well connected to the government. I mean, the government allows people to form cooperatives, but it's just another structure of ownership, of collective ownership of a program. So a cooperative here is different than a cooperative
in private,
Cuba.
Yeah.
But it sounds like what you're identifying, though, is some of these emerging small farms that are going through some similar experiences, surprisingly, perhaps similar to what's going on in Cuba, and who would have thought that?
Yeah.
So if around the United States now, there are hundreds and hundreds of places that are helping starting farmers that are mm-hmm. Saying, I want to get an organic farm, I want to supply something locally, and there are all sorts of training programs, and they're lining up, helping them identify land they could be on. And I guess what you're saying, Ellen, is that those Cuban farmers are learning to do the same thing, and mm-hmm. and it's they've gotten to this point from a whole different transition. That again, you took off three decades or something of the Communist Party of where it was controlled, and now seeing this kind of evolve.
Yes.
But there must be industrial-sized farms in Cuba as well, aren't there?
Yeah, but mostly for sugarcane and tobacco for their export crops. And I want to say something about the last 2 years, because people have been able to travel freely to Cuba from the United States for the first time since Obama opened relations. And now the Trump administration is trying to close it down again. And the thing is, we can still go pretty easily. It's really affecting Cubans being able to travel. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to encourage is that people go and support the entrepreneurs there, because you would think in a country that's really good at capitalism, we would be really supportive of these people having their own small businesses, their own small farms, and their restaurants. They have restaurants in their homes, which have been legalized by the government, called Paladars, and they also have Airbnb there, and it's legal.
Really?
And we can support it with our tourist dollars, and so we're supporting Cuban entrepreneurs, not the government. You know, they have to pay taxes, we have to pay taxes. But the fact is, these are individual entrepreneurial ventures that we can support.
So when you say we support them, and you're saying that people go to Cuba and look around to be tourists and do your Airbnb and so forth, and that's how we do it. Even though it sounds like it may get more difficult again to go there. If I wanted to get a ticket to Havana, and I'm in California, how hard is that for me to do that?
You can call Delta. You can actually do it online. This is what I did. It was amazing. You can call the major airlines that still have routes there, and Delta was one of the best, but I think Southwest and JetBlue and some of the other airlines have direct flights. And you just have to fill out a form that says why you're going, and if you say you're going on an educational tour or a cultural tour, that kind of thing, then you're in.
Oh, just a passport? And are the tickets pretty pricey?
No, it was amazing. I could have gone for $444 round trip from San Francisco to Havana with a stop in Atlanta.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just you know, making the trip 2 months in advance.
And you can actually do Airbnb too. Yep. And you're in for an adventure.
Yep.
You haven't sold me on the food yet. I like the idea of the local, but I like something beyond the rice and meat, but
absolutely.
But it sounds like it's an adventure. And there's some events taking place about a Taste of Cuba. What is that?
Well, the Taste of Cuba is this cookbook that my friend Cynthia Caras Alonso has put together. She's been traveling to Cuba for 25 years, but now she went in the last 2 years. She went on the trip when Obama was there, and she's a photographer, so photojournalist. So she started eating in all these different restaurants there and realizing that the food was improving and the chefs were getting trained in Europe and so forth. And they were using family recipes and Cuban ingredients to create better cuisine in these paladares. So that's what her cookbook is about, is the recipes from these chefs. This book is going to, you know, get national publicity. And the idea is that they have a special flair in Cuba. They have a special culture. And they're going to try to make their dishes much more palatable and try to satisfy the tastes of tourists.
So if people want to get the book, can they find it just doing the normal ways you look for a book? And
Amazon
and anything else? It's called a Taste of Cuba.
Yeah.
And I just have another question about getting the Taste of Cuba. So if I'm down there and you go out to eat it at restaurants, do they identify the farms like we do?
I didn't see that. Not yet, because most of the restaurants are in Havana, you know, in the big cities or in the more tourist areas, because tourists from Europe do go there all the time, you know, and so they do have visitors that want to support these kinds of restaurants. So I think they maybe a few of them have those connections, but it's not a big thing yet like it is here. But it could be if we ask.
Yeah. And what about supermarkets? They have supermarkets?
Yeah, and they're more stocked than they used to be in the 90s when the first time I went there. I was surprised in 2017 to see the shelves pretty full in the stores. And so, yeah, I feel like the economy there is improving and the people looked more prosperous and happier. And the success of these things that they're trying in their economy is evident.
Well, it's an interesting story, and it's also interesting to think that there's some any correlations that they're getting themselves on their feet with a different kind of agriculture, and we got some segments of American agriculture that are getting themselves started as well. And I guess one kind of a final question: we've identified where people can look for the book that you mentioned, the Taste of Cuba book. And you've also explained how people might be able to actually go Airbnb and go online and get a ticket and go round trip to Cuba for a fairly decent price. But people are just kind of curious more generally, and they were going to jump on and Google for different areas to start doing their homework about what's happening, and especially what's happening in terms of agriculture and farming and food in Cuba. Where do they look? I mean, if they're going to sit down at their computer and start doing a search, where do they find these? Start doing their homework.
Yeah, I think I would Google La Via Campesina.
How do you spell that?
It's LAVIACAMPESINA. And Peter Rosset, and his last name is Rosset, because he's been promoting the small family farms all over Latin America, including Cuba, for about 20 years, and working with, he's an academic, but he's very on the ground. He's very hands-on. So Peter Rosset, anything he's written, most of the tour books that you get about Cuba are not going to say too much about farm tours. But I also, I encourage people to go for any reason. I have friends that just went on a scuba diving trip. Some of their coral reefs are untouched because they haven't had major shipping. So they've protected them. People go on dance trips. The first one I went on was music and dance in the 90s. And I just happened to love that kind of music. But also cultural trips, the arts, language. There's many reasons to go.
And is this a good place to go if you're trying to give up using your smartphone for a while? Because I would guess that might be an issue, we're used to living on checking our phone every 5 minutes here in the States. I mean, how do you function without your iPhone getting good coverage?
Well, I would say that your phone becomes a camera, and that's it. And there's very little internet. But around the major hotels in the cities, people sort of hang around the walls outdoors of the major hotels.
So they got
hotels.
Wi-Fi in the hotels.
Yeah, in some. And the local people also are just getting cell phones. So what was really refreshing was nobody had their face in their phone all day long. Everybody was really talking to each other, and that was fun. I liked that a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. Well, Ellen Farmer, I really appreciate your sharing this conversation with us. It's something we don't think about very often, but what's going on in Cuba, and curious people will find their way there someday.
It's really close.
All right. Thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you. Okay.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.